In 2007, the Babylon podcast was our last best hope for more Lost Tales. We thought it failed. But after WonderCon, it became something more. Our last best hope for more Lost Tales geeking. The year is 2008. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast. And welcome back to the Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Hey, 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 it's Edmund from Greenville, substitute Jeffrey this week.
Yes, we are without Vorlon, so who better to pull in than a Psycop?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, thanks for filling in, Edmund. I understand that you were well-prepared for the show once Summer gave you the call, about 3 hours ago.
Absolutely. I just grabbed my DVD box, slapped in the episode, and here we are.
Well, thank the great maker for modern technology.
Absolutely.
Hey, look, before we get into the show, I do have a question. Can somebody please distill out whatever it is that JMS takes that he gets all this stuff done? You know, I was listening to Summer's new intro. And if you haven't been out to the Babylon Podcast website, you'll find the link to some information that the great maker dropped at WonderCon regarding, well, a number of things he's been up to, but including Babylon 5 graphic novel / comic book.
Mm-hmm.
So you roll that in with everything else he's doing. I imagine he's getting negative hours of sleep or something.
I would think so, between the comic lines, the movie scripts, the Hope Lost Tales 2 scripts. The man is staying extremely busy.
Right. There's also, he didn't mention it in the WonderCon comments, but there is the television show that he was working on with partners that he could not name by name.
Oh, yeah.
And the last post I read about that was they were talking about going ahead with it, you know, rather than hooking up with a studio and get it started, they were just going to go ahead and produce like 10 episodes and then shop that around to maintain the certain creative freedom. So you've got that project. Rumor has it that Ron Howard has put option rights on a Lensman movie. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, well, we know who's going to be writing that thing.
Oh, yeah.
Hmm. So, I'm thinking it's like he got a head start with the writer strike. Because writer strike doesn't affect comic books. The WGA strike didn't affect comic book writers at all.
Right.
He probably gets like 1 hour of sleep a night. The rest is just telepathically induced REM sleep.
It must be.
He's got a telepath somewhere in a closet in his office, mm-hmm. and for 5 minutes every hour, boom, like instantaneous REM sleep. He's rejuvenated and he keeps on going, but then he has to actually sleep for a full hour later.
Yeah, I think the Link to Ray might be capable of doing that. Actually.
Well, how do I get signed up? I got plenty of things that I need to get done, and I just can't seem to get anything moving forward these days.
I think the cost is astronomical because of the toll it takes on the telepath, you know.
Oh, that's true.
Because when do they sleep?
Well, they sleep once they've taken care of the mundanes. Well, since we're bringing up telepaths, maybe what we should do is take a quick break and then come back and talk about Walkabout, which it returns one of our favorite telepaths.
Mm-hmm.
In a world where we wait for a new Farscape series. One small crew sends out a beacon of hope to scapers everywhere.
Hi, this is Ben Browder.
Hi, I'm Claudia Black.
Hi, I'm David Franklin.
Hi, this is Rayleigh Hill.
Hi, this is Paul Goddard.
Hi, I'm Gigi Edgley, and you're listening to The Scapecast.
Hi, everyone.
Attention.
Last time in our hero's journey.
La, la, la.
Well, you are, she says as she's knocking John out with her rifle.
I'm Wendy Hembrock with the news.
Yeah, baby, it's time once again.
My word.
L-M-N-O-P.
You know, I'm tired of these mother frelly stings of my mother frelling Leviathan.
Holy cannoli.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer will be dead.
Oh, no.
You can find the Scapecast at scapecast.org.
Every time I think that there's more to you than a pair of pushed-up loomers and a corset.
Loomer.
If only we had some way to keep up our stamina.
Naughty mist.
Does Mummy know your hair?
Oh, no. Mummy doesn't know.
Here's your rematch, Crichton.
What a lovely fantasy of family reconciliation.
Where's your neck?
Shut up.
The Scapecast. Your guide to the wonders of Farscape.
Digging down into the most obscure facts in fandom, this is
B.E.
And we are back with our deep, deep geeking.
Yes.
Now, this episode, I have to admit, the first time I saw it, it seemed uneven to me. It really did.
Yeah.
But on later rewatchings, there's, I guess, not as much of an imbalance as I thought. But it's still, I don't know, there's just like some part of that story with the singer in Down Below and the tension in the tele, you know, using Lita, who returns, to test out a theory. It didn't seem to, it didn't complement, but it didn't match either. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, it one of the things that I reflected on and just took a quick glance at a couple of the episodes that are coming up, these are less, well, standalone isn't the right word, you know, but up to this point, the episodes, while they've tied into the much larger epic narrative, they've also been solid stories in and amongst themselves. And the stories in this episode seem to be more of a snapshot kind of thing. You know, it's not that it's a plot with a beginning, a rising action, turning point, falling action, and climax. You know, this is, you know, these are just little snapshots. I mean, that's the only way I can think of it. We've got Stephen Franklin going down below on his walkabout, and he runs into a torch singer in a Down Below nightclub, and you know their paths cross, and then they kind of disentangle and they go on. We have Lita coming back to the station. We have the new Vorlon coming on board. Our heroes test out the theory of telepaths having effect on the shadow vessels. They find out that it does work, and then they move on. You know, it's not that there's there's not that kind of a tension involved. But I think, like I said, you start looking at the next few episodes, you think of, you know, Gray 17 is missing. Same thing. You know, this the sort of bogus story of Garibaldi fighting the alien monster thing with his grandmother's revolver, but you've also got Delenn, or rather, Naroon and Marcus squaring off regarding Delenn's station as Entel Zah. So, you know, and these are, at this point, it's more like the stories are being dictated by the universe rather than the writer dictating the universe, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, they have to go in and just sort of, and there are certain plot points to make to move us forward to the end of the season. And so it's like we're getting these little bits of the middle of the story.
And I see, right. Yeah, I see the part with the experiment on the White Star. I see that as more than just a bit. That's an important cog, both in a tool that, you know, our alliance is going to use against the shadows. But it also knocks over the first domino in the shadows going, what are we going to do about this Sheridan guy? Hey, look, his wife.
Right. Right. But that's and I agree with you there. I think, again, the point is, though, that it's not, you know, a traditional plot, if you will. It's more like we got to figure out if this thing works. OK. You know, there's a bit of tension. Does it work? Yeah, it does. But again, that's, you know, that's not a moment of triumph. It's just simply, all right, like you said, Summer, it's just sort of ratcheting up things at this point. So, well, let's take a step back. Let's start with the appearance of the new Vorlon. We open up with Captain Sheridan going for a walk outside. He's out there in a pressure suit walking on one of the freight loading arms, and the new Vorlon's ship comes through the jump gate, stops before the docking bay, and raises up in front of him and spells out something on his skin.
Yep.
And many,
so do we have any?
Yeah, I have actually looked a couple of times. I haven't done any in-depth digging, but I've never found anything that specifically stated what that said.
I think I know what it says. Now, I also went back to see whether or not it was the same glyphs that were displayed on the ship's side in Hunter Prey. And I must admit to my disappointment, they were different. But my guess is something to the effect of, I loved you in Tron, you were great.
That would be good.
Just a guess. No, it. You know, I would think that it says something of some import. Now, you know, back to the humorous end of it. JMS, you know, maintains it's the equivalent of Aloha, much like Veer's shirt.
Yeah, so. But yeah. That can't be it. I mean, how does a Vorlon know what, you know, Aloha means?
Right.
And what does a Vorlon look like wearing a Hawaiian shirt?
Oh, yeah.
Would we ever see a Vorlon with a Hawaiian shower curtain?
A very good point.
It might be the only way a Vorlon gets laid.
Oh,
where's Jeffrey when you need him?
Here we are in an episode laden with Vorlon appearances and there's no Vorlon to comment on them.
Quite honestly, I did want to ask Jeffrey what it was like coming down that ramp when he first appears as Bullcash, etc. Having actually listened to this show for a while now, it's like I do see the Kosh scenes a little differently, knowing who's actually inside there.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you remember some of his comments that when the Ulkesh costume was created, they created it more for an eye of, well, comfort may not be the right word, but so that it was a little more bearable.
Yeah.
So yeah, that has changed my perception of of that as well. That's funny. But yeah, so Ulkesh shows up, or Kosh, and there is a different tone to this Vorlon when he appears.
Yeah.
He's cryptic, but on top of that, he's very curt. Okay, you know, we heard from your government that you... Well, here's another one. Now that I bring it up, how do they contact the Vorlon government?
I don't know if that was that they contacted the Vorlon government so much as the Vorlon government sent them a memo.
That could be. You're right. They said your government said. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so they just send messages back and saying... And you really get the feeling... Maybe just from the shortness that he mentioned of the notes, like, you know, they didn't say what, you know, your name. It's like, well, call me Kosh. And you get the feeling from this new Vorlon that he really doesn't want to have anything to do with humans.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't see them as fondly as the Kosh we've grown to know does. And
well,
it's
no, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting because we don't see Kosh interact with. Do we see Ulkesh interact with Delenn at all?
He's one of the Vorlons, if I recall correctly. He's one of the Vorlons that appears in Dukat's quarters and in the beginning. But you know what? It's been a while since I've watched that, so I can't vouch for it. Now it's a different Vorlon. See, now I'm really going to shoot myself in the foot, but I don't think it's the same Vorlon on Minbar when Sinclair departs.
I would think that wouldn't be. But yeah, we just, right. You know, you get the feeling that this Vorlon is colder, doesn't really want to deal with the less evolved species, but
right.
They come in real handy in their fight against the shadows. You get the distinct feeling that he doesn't care that these people will die because they're just there.
Oh, the cannon fodder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we see almost immediately after the command staff leaves, Ulkesh or Kosh, we are all Kosh, runs into Leeta, who's arrived on the station rather distraught that Kosh had died, trying mm-hmm. to get back to find out what happened.
Yeah.
And Ulkesh basically slaps her around. Mm-hmm. You know, she shows up and tries to start talking, and all of a sudden she's gasping for breath.
Basically, he just mind reams her as near as we can tell to mm-hmm. try and find out who knows.
Yeah, and he's not as considerate mm-hmm. of her as she had become accustomed to.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I've always found that interesting that as we've gone to know Kosh and as off-putting as he could be, I love the way they immediately, with the new Vorlon, managed to bring this whole different character in. You just immediately sense the shift.
Right.
You know, as strange as the original Kosh was, you know, it's like, ooh, hold on. These guys can't
be mere. And that tells you that something is up. You know, well, Ulkesh is looking for the essence of Kosh. And part of what he's scanning Leeta for is to find out what happened and where is Kosh? Well, when Leeta talks to Sheridan about what he knows, that's when she discovers that Kosh might not be altogether gone. And that comes in handy when they finally put together the plan to go out hunting the shadow ship
mm-hmm.
with using Leeta as the psychic weapon. Mm-hmm. She, as they make the approach, she starts, her resolve starts to flag in that psychic combat until she hears Kosh's voice projected out of Sheridan into her mind, and she doesn't hear the voice. She gets the flash of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Sheridan grasps her hand, tries to give her comfort, and in a flash she discovers what happened, and that gives her the resolve to fight back.
Yeah, once she knows it was the shadows who tore him apart, as she mm-hmm. says.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was more like they knew who had killed him, but she didn't know, no one knew how until she saw that, and that, I guess, the viciousness of that enraged her. And I thought that was actually kind of telling, because we see later where her anger fuels her telepathic strength. So this mm-hmm. might have just been the start of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So we do discover that with a telepath, a single telepath can take on a single Shadow Battle Crab, which is very good for our heroes at that moment. Not so good when your one telepath has sort of drained herself, and three more shadow ships show up to take you on. Fortunately, the cavalry comes to the rescue.
Yes. And that, I think that is probably one of the Garibaldi's speech towards Jakar when he realizes that Sheridan has gone out there without the support that he needs. That level of passion in that speech always just struck me. He's like, here's your book back.
Yeah. Do not thumb the book of Jaquan. Right. And what is interesting is it's almost a turnaround in that when Jakar wanted to get into the council, the war council, what was his comment? Many Narn had died to defend this place. And so, you know, I was good on my promise. Now it's time for you to be good on yours. And now the tables are turned. They can use that support, and Jakar says, well, you know, I talked to the captain, and he says, well, you know, he doesn't really want to commit the vessel because, you know, we're going to need every ship we can use to save Homeworld. And Garibaldi says, no, you know, he doesn't see the bigger picture. You do. And, I like that. I thought that was good. It was very much calling out his leadership.
Yeah. And it was more than that. It was pointing out to him, look, I've watched you grow emotionally and spiritually as a person here. You have the vision. You've seen what's going on. You know the big picture. It's your job to tell them what they need to do because they don't see it like you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, thinking about it, Garibaldi's critical in both of those turnabouts in that battle, because he's the one who also, in the war council first, starts pushing Sheridan to bring the Mimbari along and bring other telepaths along just in case, and Sheridan's trying to keep the possible casualties to a minimum. And it's Garibaldi who starts pushing him to make sure there are reinforcements.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because it doesn't do us any good. You know, it's the same deal. It's the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, look, this isn't just about making a little sortie. We need that information. And for you to get it, we got to give you everything you need.
You're going to have to risk some people. And if we need to know if you need more than one telepath to stop one of these things.
Right. Right. So, yes, I agree with you, Summer. That was a very, very impassioned speech. And, you know, you can, without seeing it, you can just hear as he's ringing Jakar's doorbell.
Yeah.
I mean, can you see a furious Garibaldi hammering at that button?
And that was good. That whole scene there where you see, I guess he's finally believing in something. He's like, okay, we got to do this because we're here, and damn it, you said you were going to help. You're not helping. Get with it.
Right.
Or step away.
In
for a penny, in for a pound.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we have Jakar and everyone, it seems, coming to the rescue. And I think it wasn't until I had rewatched the episode like a second or third time that I realized, oh, wow, he's got a lot of the races on board coming in to help. They're going to notice that. That's where they noticed.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. You know, you want to talk about bigger picture. At that point, Jakar's leadership extends beyond just the Narn. You know, he's starting to rally the League of Non-Aligned Worlds, or what's left of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be important. And that is... as much as, you know, the revelation that the Army of Light has discovered what telepaths can do, the fact that they are uniting all the various factions is important. Because, you know, part of the Shadow's MO is divide and conquer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or divide and cause chaos.
Right. And I wonder how much of that has to do with the leaders of the other worlds see Jakar in a position of authority at Babylon 5, because he got the Narns to come in to fill in for the security forces. That helps them as well as Earth, the Earth staff, you know, by keeping the station safer.
Yep.
And they're part of that too. So they probably saw that and went, you know, hey, Jakar is someone we can, you know, maybe listen to in this. I often wondered that. I wasn't sure because I haven't seen any confirmation of it, but it's the only thing that I can think of that made sense.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, and you also just get the sense that that whole moral authority that he's starting to build up is also just starting to show that people are listening to him now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, in a very real sense, it's one thing to have the epiphany that changes how, you know, you view the world. It's a whole other thing. But I think Garibaldi, again, he says it, you know, when the chips are down, you know, it's one thing when everything's going your way, you know, but it's a whole other thing when the chips are down and you got to risk it all. You know, that's where you show your true character and what's it going to be. Yeah. Great stuff. See, that's, you know, like you said earlier, Summer, at first glance, it's sort of, you know, just kind of this, you know, this episode that doesn't necessarily come together, but the various pieces work very nicely.
Also, at that end of the battle when all the ships come in, it's just to underline it, of course, that's when Kosh's voice comes back into Lita's head.
Mm-hmm.
Back, and so it begins.
And I think that's where she's really, truly certain. You know, she
probably
had an inkling when she saw it through, you know, saw what happened to Kosh by touching Sheridan. But then hearing his voice in her head, you know, that's when she knows, yeah, there is somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah, and she tells Alkesh as much.
Yeah. Although it's interesting, she just says that she thinks there's part of Kosh out there, but she doesn't say where.
Yes. She said there. I think there is a piece of him in someone, and she never tells him. And I wonder, you know, does he find out on his own later? Or was that just not considered a relevant exchange? Because you'd think he would want to go grab that piece, maybe.
Yeah.
But then I don't know if he can take it forcibly out of someone.
Yeah, that's interesting. You see, I got the impression they were looking for what was left of Kosh, you know, to draw a really... strain the analogy in the same way, you know, you think of in the Star Trek movies where they're looking for Spock's chakra and trying to reunite with the body. I wonder if that's kind of the same concept here. We're all Kosh. We want what we can get of whatever might pass away because we're diminished. But, you know, I also got the sense that Lita didn't say, I think I know, you know, I think there's a part of Kosh still around. And I think it's in Sheridan's head. I think that she didn't reveal that because I think that's the beginning of, you know, almost a bit of a rebellion on her part. Her first encounter with Alkesh is basically trying to choke the life out of her to get what she knows out. You know, there's no gentle quality to it. So, you know, she gives him the information he wants. Is there bits of Kosh around? Yeah. And that's all you're going to, you know, you haven't asked the right question, so I'm not going to offer the information.
Right.
You know, I think that was purposeful on her part.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because she said there might be, not that there is, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That gives her some time, as well as giving the other Vorlons a little bit of hope.
Right. Yeah. All right, now we come to the other part of the episode, the walkabout of the title.
Yes.
Walkabout of Dr. Franklin.
Right. One of the things that I really enjoyed about this immediately was I loved when Garibaldi found Franklin. And Franklin's reaction was just kind of, you know, this resignation. It's like, I wondered when you were going to show up. You know, not even like, what are you doing here? It's just like, okay, you know, I knew this was going to happen.
Yeah, you found me, fine.
more like, okay, right. What took you so long?
Right, right. The tale is, Franklin, on walkabout, he wanders into a down below bar, is taken by a torch singer. They have a bit of a fling, but Franklin finds that, you know, she asks him to get a particular kind of medication, which apparently was addictive. I mean, they didn't say it as such, but it was something seriously enough that Franklin said, well, you know, don't ask me that. I'll do anything else you need me to do.
Yeah, it was a very, very potent narcotic painkiller.
Right.
And you actually didn't find out that it was a painkiller until later. But you knew from his reaction that it was a strong drug, a potent drug, something he didn't think she should be taking lightly.
Right.
Or casually, I guess, would be the better word.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, there was a conversation after, you know, post-coital bliss, and she's drinking, and, mm-hmm. and he's like, well, you know, you'd do well without drinking all this stuff, and then she asks for this. He's like, no, you know, I can't do that. He eventually finds her passed out with one of these containers, so he thinks that she's OD'd on it. And as it turns out, she's actually been diagnosed with a terminal illness, and she uses this medicine basically to get through the day.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that whole scene in med lab where he's getting ready to run in there and, you know, save her from the drug, I'm like, yeah, he's projecting here a little bit.
Yeah, right. I was going to say that was the thing that really struck me in this episode was that, you know, it's the beginning of the walkabout process, and what is good is where, you know, Franklin thinks that he's surrendered, you know, as he tells Garibaldi, you know, they get to talking, and you're talking about the concept of walkabout, and you walk out and you meet yourself and talk about everything, and Garibaldi says, well, you're ridiculous, you're a doctor, you're a scientist, and Franklin says, and what? And Garibaldi says, what do you mean, what? And yeah. Franklin's point is, exactly. Well, he thinks by leaving his post in med lab, he has shed himself of that persona, except he really hasn't. You know, his assumption is that this woman needs to be saved. She's drinking too much, she's taking, you know, she's addicted to some medicine, and I know what's best. I'm not a doctor anymore, but thinking that he's not a doctor, he might think that, you know, things are going to be better, but it's really deeper than that. It's in his personality. And, you know, he's shocked to find out that the reason she's asking for this drug is because, you know, she's dying. And there he is, one more example of trying to fix things and screwing it up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, almost screwing it up.
Right.
The part where you see his reaction, it's like you kind of get the feeling that's the reaction he maybe subconsciously wishes somebody had had with him, even though technically Garibaldi did.
Yeah. You know, I always like that scene when she first brings up getting the drug, because just given his recent history, so, you know, his immediate assumption is, you know, oh, it's something she's addicted to, and even I think for the audience as well, it's like they've gotten to, with the stem addiction coming up, that's where the audience automatically goes as well, and to have it flipped at the end and finally find out what's going on works really well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I liked her reasons. You know, Franklin talking to her, it's like, you know, why don't you go back to Earth? You know, you're excellent, and you know, you're a fantastic singer. I know even with the, you know, short time, you could, you know, do really well for yourself. And her whole point was, you know, I'm doing just fine. I don't need to be fixed. There's a reason I'm here. You know, I'm mm-hmm. dying. What does it matter if I die here or on Earth?
Yeah.
And, of course, that she likes being in Down Below, giving pleasure and comfort to these people who really need it.
Yeah, basically lightening the burden for other people, given the time that she has.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, these people need to, you know, need this more than, you know, the people back on Earth. Well, not now, but the, you know, she's seen what it is down below. She lives down there. She can help in the only way she knows how to, and that's what she's going to do for as long as she's got left.
You know what? I, as we're talking about this, something has occurred to me, and there's this thread that's running through Babylon 5. We see it primarily with these, you know, one-off characters, if you will. But go back to Grail, think about Exogenesis, Quality of Mercy, and it's these characters who, on the surface, you would think could be doing better, but it turns out that they're finding their true purpose where they need to be. And it's not necessarily glamorous, but it's following a calling and just allowing that to lead them to where they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
I just find that interesting. I mean, I know, you know, I mean, and in a sense, that's kind of what Franklin's issue is. He's trying to find where he's supposed to be, you know, and accept that. I guess really what I'm talking about are people, you know, these characters accepting what is given to them and working with that and making their lives the best they can be. Rather than you know on a cognitive level thinking this is what I need to do to make things right and not really listening to their inner voice.
Mm-hmm.
So
works for me.
One last comment I have about that part of Walkabout is, and this is just my own personal taste, how come nobody walks into a futuristic version of CBGBs? You know, we either get in science fiction, we either get this bogus sort of electronic music that says, ooh, future music, or it's, you know, torchy lounge singers. You know, I want to hear the Ramones.
I don't know.
I would
like to see a little hole in the wall with a mosh pit. I want to see aliens. I want to see Brakiri and Drazi in a mosh pit.
There you go.
Yeah.
Exactly. with a Pachmara over the bar and a pitcher of beer.
Now the Pachmara is the drummer.
Yeah, I like that. That's good.
That's what I want. I want. I'm going to have to run with that now because I can't get it out of my head.
Yeah. You see, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, on the Lurker's Guide, JMS responds to comments at the time of, you know, why does it sound like it's, you know, contemporary music, and Straczynski replies with, you know, people are making classical style music even today. It's not, you know, it didn't end with Beethoven and Brahms, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, even more contemporary, he cites Stevie Ray Vaughan as playing the blues and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, it's just, he was comfortable with it. I mean, that's all well and good. It's just, you know, the thing is, when you get to music, you really start, you know, it transcends personal taste and starts verging on religious fanaticism.
Yeah, so. In some cases it does, yeah.
Plus, I guess,
the blues will stay the same, rock and roll will stay the same, pop music will always change and just kind of be oatmeal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, plus, of course, since JMS wrote the songs, he wanted to make sure everybody could actually hear them.
Oh.
Yeah, that's true, he did write the lyrics.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
All right. In that case, that will conclude our deep geeking for Walkabout. I'm going to go ponder some music right now, but we'll be back in a in a minute or two with a couple of emails.
They tap into your bloodstream like tiny little vampires. They hack into your nervous system like you were a walking computer network built just for them. They flood your body with chemicals that cause fear, paranoia, and psychotic rage. It's a disease that thinks. It's a disease that talks. And if you're lucky, you die before it becomes a disease that walks. On April Fool's Day, experience the horror thriller novel, Infected, the major hardcover release from number one bestselling author, Scott Sigler, creator of the free podcast novels, Earthcore, Ancestor, and Nocturnal. Available April 1st, online and in bookstores everywhere. Free audio chapters of Infected are available at scottsigler.com and infectednovel.com. The disease kills you slowly if the cure doesn't kill you first.
All right, we're back from listener feedback.
Yeah, just a little bit to kind of round out the show. This is, you might say these are D-mails we have from Dave, Dave, and Dusty.
All right,
here we go. This is from Dave in Pennsylvania, and he's regarding talking to our Nat in English now, referencing our discussion with Mike about War Without End. If I understand what you guys were saying, especially your guest, you are saying that the Shadow War and the Earth Civil War were two different stories. I do not see it that way. It is a combined whole. I don't think it would have made sense any other way. The way I look at it is that to make Babylon 5 the centerpiece of the Shadow War, JMS had to get Earth out of the way. It would not have made much sense to have Sheridan and B5 being the leaders of the Shadow War and gaining alliances with all the various other worlds if they were still on good terms with Earth and the President. Why would not Earth and the Joint Chiefs and the President send the whole military might of Earth to help in the war if Santiago had still been President? Santiago seemed to be a friend of Sheridan and Sinclair and a supporter of B5, and I think he would have been more than willing to help in the Shadow War. But then it would not have been a B5 war, but an Earth war with B5 as a minor player. Sorry I'm rambling, and maybe I misunderstood what you were saying, but I thought this seemed obvious to me. Well, I think what Mike was saying is he thought that the Earth Civil War was a superfluous tale.
Yes, that's what he was saying.
Yeah. Right.
He said, his thought was that the Earth Civil War, the conflict as it was portrayed in season 4, was anticlimactic to everything that had been built up in the second and third and first half of the fourth seasons. And right. I think it would have turned out better if we had, if season 5 had been approved earlier, because I honestly do think that the Earth Civil War would have taken up the first half of season 5, and then season 5 would have everything up until the point where the Centauri infiltration, so to speak, by the Drak happened. Mm-hmm. And you know, that would have led up to the end of season 5, and then we would have gotten a couple of movies about the fall of Centauri Prime or mm-hmm. the novels. And I just think that the Earth Civil War would have, it did feel too compressed because of how they wanted to finish the Earth War, clear all that up, give everybody closure just in case there wasn't a fifth season. But I think
that's true to a certain extent, but I really think what suffered was the Minbari Civil War. That to me was really it was really perfunctory.
Yeah, that was,
you know, that was all about three episodes.
That was extremely compressed.
Yeah. Right. I didn't have that issue with the Earth Civil War. I actually kind of liked that pace. I think that because the pressures of reality upon the production caused things to be compressed, I think what happened was you had a whole lot of things happening all at once, and for my money anyways, it was a lot more tense because it wasn't just simply the Earth Civil War going on there. You also have to keep in mind there was the subplot with Eggers Industries and the telepath drug and getting Garibaldi. Basically was turned out he's been brainwashed, but he doesn't know it, so he's the tool they use to capture Sheridan. I really never had a problem with it. I mean, would it have been a more satisfying meal had it been stretched out more? Yeah, perhaps. But I don't have the issue with it as a lot of people do. I really liked how taut a lot of that storytelling became.
Yeah, I know. Certainly when I was first watching it, I mean, it was an amazing roller coaster ride through the end of that fourth season. I mean, you just felt exhausted by the time.
I'm not saying I didn't like it. I just, you know, yeah. Having it go a little bit longer would have been nice.
Yeah. I mean, I know the split I've heard is that Intersections in Real Time would have been the fourth season.
Right, finale. Right. Yeah, I've heard that too.
You know, a totally different feeling. Of, you know,
that would have been a kicker of a season finale. You're going to leave me hanging here?
Yeah, right on such an abstract note.
Yeah. You know, instead, you know, wound up being this amazing cathartic, you know, blast through to the end of season four.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, ready for the next one?
Sure.
This is from Dave K. from Kentucky. Hi, everyone, especially Summer. Got an iPod for Christmas, found your show on iTunes, saw the title and was hooked. Just finished listening to the last 50 shows, helps getting a B5 fix on the go. Really like the new intro Summer made. I think what hooked me on the show was when I first saw the fighters in action and how they reacted so realistically, not like other sci-fi where ships acted like they were in atmosphere or just did whatever they felt like. Haven't heard from Yarsto lately. Did someone chain him up in a studio working on Voices of Babylon? By the way, Voices of Babylon is excellent, the best thing I've heard in ages. It's almost like watching all new episodes of B5. Thanks to everyone on both podcasts. Keep up the great work. I brought that in because Yarsto is in absentia, so that's Edmund sitting in for Jeffrey and Yarsto.
Let me just say thank you very much for extremely kind words.
Yes.
And yes, we have Yarsto chained up in the... Studio.
Yeah. The problem is that he likes it too much.
Yeah.
I'm so not going there.
Okay, here we go. Last one. This is from Dusty. And I'm going to start off with actually the end of his email because I think this is a really important thing. He says, I just came back from a 6-month cruise to the Gulf. And that would be, I'm guessing, the Persian Gulf. My wife would download and send me the podcast to help me get a fix. I am finally getting caught up and really enjoy your podcast. Your podcast, The Tenth Wonder, which is a Heroes podcast, and Voices of Babylon are the three casts I always listen to. So, on the question of Narn telepaths and what happened to them, when Shaquan led the other Mind Walkers against the Shadows 1,000 years ago, the Shadows would have retaliated. We know the biogenetics capabilities they had. We know from Crusade, the Shadows have been using plagues for a very long time. After the Mind Walkers drove the Shadows off Narn, the Shadows could have created a Narn telepath plague. Since the number of telepaths were already low after fighting to drive the Shadows away, any remaining telepaths dying of disease couldn't be noticed. Excuse me. The plague would have ended itself once the number of telepaths in the population were so reduced. The plague would have died out as well. End result, no more telepaths or enough with the gene to breed a true Narn telepath. Any chance mutation or natural Narn telepath would die as well. Even today, we do know of hardy bacteria and viruses that inhabit our planet. So keep up the good work. Enjoy each and every episode. That's an interesting theory right there.
Yeah,
that's,
it is.
That's a new one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't made the connection with the telepath virus that Earth came up with later. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that could very well be an option, a scenario.
Right, yeah. Right.
It also brings up the possibility, did Edgar's Industries happen upon any shadow technology when they were coming up with their virus?
Well, you know, there is that sort of tangled web with IPX and, you know, all the biotech that they were digging for. So, yeah, Edmund, I think you might be onto something there.
Yeah, and they are Mars, after all. There is a certain Psycor presence there.
As well, you should know.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for email for tonight. Please send in, and people who are sending voicemails, we love getting those, but please keep your comments short and succinct. If you have multiple points to make, feel free to send in multiple emails.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Multiple voicemails,
Yeah, we've gotten a couple that were good, but, you know, there's only room for one long-winded person on the show, and I'm sitting in that chair.
Well, I guess thank you, Edmund, for joining us for today's Geeking in Commentary.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yep.
And if you want to break Yarsto out of whatever cage he's being held in by the Voices of Babylon crew, please feel free to donate. There's a donation button right there on our website. Basically, help keep Tim fed. Or actually help keep Brad fed with Tim's cookies. And
there we go.
And we're have to pay for a little bit of, you know, Mike's new mixer board, since that's where he does all the recording work. But if you want to send us your own commentaries, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Or if you want to leave us a voicemail, short and sweet, please. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.